Hello and welcome back to another PaleoCast.
I'm Joe Keating.
And I'm Dave Marshall.
And we're here in Bristol University.
Yep, it's a special day for Joe because I've come down to visit for the day.
Yeah, and I'm not on the phone. This time you can hear me well. That's not going in the intro.
Yeah, so I'm very happy to be back here in Bristol. This is my academic home where I actually learn how to be a paleontologist on their MSc Paleobiology, which is, what I took. And quite a lot of paleontologists from the UK do this course. I think it's quite a significant proportion of them.
Yeah, I think it's one of very few universities that offer a master's specifically in paleontology, and so it's very popular. And there's quite a thriving community of paleontologists here. And I showed Dave, and he was very excited to see my heterostracon material.
Yeah, so little bits of fish that I didn't really know what they were. But I do know all about early vertebrate evolution and extinction from last week, so
yes,
I knew round about what they were.
So what are we doing today, then?
Yeah, we're here today to interview Dr. Maria McNamara, who's a postdoctoral researcher here at Bristol University.
We're going to be talking about colour in fossils, which is something that I never dreamed would ever be able to talk about when I was a kid looking at dinosaur books and books about fossils. But amazingly, you can actually, or at least we're starting to be able to find out about colour in fossil organisms. Why is colour important to animals?
Well, animals today use colour for lots of different reasons and has lots of different functions. Most obviously, animals use colour for communication, for visual signalling. So they might use colour patterns for camouflage or as warning signals, or maybe even for signalling during mating for sexual display. But animals also use colour for other reasons as well, related to physiology. So they, some colours, for instance, some pigments like melanin, they're used in photoprotection. They actually protect against harmful UV rays from the sun. That's why we get freckles in our skin, for instance. It's just the melanin trying to protect ourselves from UV damage. And some pigments are also involved in sequestering toxic metal ions from the body. So it's a way of kind of getting rid of any toxins that you're, that you take in, that you ingest as well.
Okay, so you mentioned pigments there being important in production of colour. Could you perhaps expand a little bit on that?
Okay, so yeah, I mean, pigments are one way of generating colour. So pigments are basically chemicals, and they work by selectively absorbing light of certain wavelengths. So, for instance, chlorophyll is a pigment we're very familiar with because it makes the green colour in many leaves. And so how the chlorophyll pigment produces that green colour is the chemical bonds in the pigment absorb light of red wavelengths, of red and blue. And so that leaves the green wavelengths to just be reflected from the surface. So that's how pigments make colour.
Can they produce a whole variety of colours?
Yeah, I mean, using pigments, you can generate, different pigment families will generate different colours. So you can generate reds, oranges and yellows using pigments called carotenoids. These are what make carrots orange, for instance. But animals can't make carotenoids. So if animals want to make these yellows and reds in their skin or their hair or their plumage, they have to actually eat plants containing carotenoids. But only some animals can actually metabolize them to make those colors. Humans, for instance, we can't. We eat carotenoids, they pass straight through. But many birds, for instance, if they eat plants with carotenoids, they can actually retain those pigments in their tissues to give their feathers yellows and oranges.
Is that what happens with flamingos?
Yes, yeah, that's how flamingos generate that pink colour. It's the red algae that they ingest. So carotenoids are one type of pigment, but you can get a whole range of other colours. You can generate blues and purples using pigments too.
So is there any particular reason why animals didn't evolve carotenoids? Is it that for some reason they can't chemically produce that, or they just never evolved it in the first
place? It's basically, you know, mammals never evolved the metabolic pathway to be able to deal with carotenoids and be able to use them in our systems. For whatever reason, signalling in yellow and red and orange was never important for mammals. And this might actually hark back to the evolutionary origins of the group, because, you know, they were probably nocturnal, the first mammals. So, you know, signalling in these bright colours wouldn't have been very useful. It would have been a waste of energy, basically. So that might be one reason why, just, you know, we never, in our past, we never, you know, there was no evolutionary reason for using these pigments. Doesn't say that they won't evolve in the future, but...
So, in fossils, a lot of the biological material is replaced by minerals, and generally only the large-scale structures are preserved, and very rarely cells. So, how is it possible that these melanosomes, or which are organelles within a cell, can be preserved when the cells themselves can't be preserved?
Well, the thing about melanosomes is... melanosomes are basically these pigment organelles. So they're small little bodies, about the size of a micron, inside cells. And they occur in feathers and in hair. You don't find them in insects, for instance. So in order for melanosomes to be preserved, what actually happens is the melanosomes, they're in feathers, they're no longer within cells. During feather development, there are these special melanin-producing cells called melanocytes. They produce the melanosomes. The melanosomes migrate into the developing feather, and they're pushed out along the barbs and barbules in the feather structure. And as to why they're preserved, that's something that people are still working on right now. There's a lot of data out there explaining why... explaining why melanin is robust. We know, for instance, people who've done work on feather processing, for instance, there's huge amounts of waste produced in the feather processing industry, and it's very difficult to get rid of feathers because of their melanin. And we know that feathers that have more melanin in them are more robust and more resistant to bacterial attack. So we know, kind of in an everyday sense, that melanin is more resistant to decay. But in terms of the actual steps involved in preservation, and, you know, both of the morphology and the chemistry, you know, people are still working on that at the moment.
So what kind of animals have melanosomes preserved in the fossil record?
Okay, so in the fossil record, most fossil melanosomes are inside feathers, most definitive melanosomes. We do find, there have been a few studies out in the last year, actually, of melanosomes within the eyes of fossil fish and within the ink sacs of fossil squid. So there's probably more melanin out there than we currently realise. The stories are coming out.
How did we first realise that the colour was caused by melanosomes?
Okay, well, that's actually a tricky way of putting it, because these fossils, they actually don't, many of these fossil feathers, they don't show colour at all. They just look dark. That's the key issue, that there was, in most fossil feathers, there is no obvious colour banding. It's only when you look with the SEM, under like really high magnification, that you find these little melanosomes that are evidence of colour. So in terms of how melanosomes were first discovered, little microstructures, little micron-sized spheres and sausages, they were known from lots of different fossils for the past 25, 30 years or so. But people had assumed that they were not melanosomes, but in fact fossil bacteria. Because these things, melanosomes and bacteria, they're the same size, they're the same shape, they both occur in the soft tissues of the fossil. And so it wasn't until about 4 years ago now, a paper by Jakob Winter, who was a then PhD student with Derek Briggs at Yale University in the States, he realized that what we had been interpreting as bacteria were in fact melanosomes. So he basically looked at some fossil feathers which had striking banding. And he realized that you're only finding melanosomes in the dark bands, not the light bands. So so this was a totally new interpretation of these fossils. And since then, melanosomes have been found in lots of other fossil feathers.
Is it common to get bacteria on feathers? Did it take one special specimen which didn't have much bacteria on the feathers to be able to tell that the dark has these little sausage shapes and the light doesn't have the little sausage shapes?
Well, you see, that's still an issue. You know, I actually did decay experiments on feathers, and the bacteria that colonized the feathers during decay, they look the exact same as the melanosomes. They're the exact same size and shape. So, you know, the key arguments for interpreting these structures as melanosomes and not bacteria actually relate to exactly where you find them. You know, finding them in the dark bands and not the light bands, that's a little bit hard to explain if you're just talking about bacterial colonization. They should colonize the whole feather. And also some subsequent papers by a group including Paddy Orr in UCD and Mike Benton at Bristol and Chinese colleagues, they realised that they only found the melanosomes inside an organic covering. So they interpreted this organic coating as the original keratin sheath or film that's around the outside of the feather in life, and they only found the melanosomes inside. So that's pretty good evidence that the microstructures are melanosomes and not bacteria.
So does this lead us to be able to reconstruct the colours of animals known only from the fossil record?
It certainly offers the potential of doing this. What we now know is that the precise geometry of melanosomes in modern birds controls the colour. So, you know, if they're, say, for instance, more sausage-shaped or more squashed, more rounded, you'll actually generate different colours in your feathers. So, you know, in theory, all we have to do is look at the geometry of fossil melanosomes and compare the size and shape of what we get in modern feathers to actually be able to reconstruct the colour. There is one problem with using fossil material, though, and that is that you know, no fossil is a perfect analogue of a living beast. And you always have to consider the effects of the fossilization process. And this is something that hasn't been well constrained yet. So we actually don't know how the rigors of decay and burial, for instance, actually affect the geometry of melanosomes. And this is something that we're working on at the moment.
So which colours can melanosomes actually produce in birds?
In birds, the most common colours that you get from melanosomes are blacks and browns, reddish browns and greys. But if you combine melanosomes in feathers with other structures, colour producing nanostructures, structural colours, you can actually generate a whole much broader range of colours.
What is this structural method of coloration?
Structural colors are completely different to pigments. So pigments are chemicals. They work by absorbing light, specific wavelengths. But structural colors, they're actually generated using a physical process. You don't need chemicals at all. So what happens is you have these, where you have ordered structures inside tissues, where you have structures that are ordered on a very fine scale, on a scale of nanometers. When light comes into the structure, you get constructive interference. And so instead of, you know, getting a very broad range of wavelengths reflected, you just selectively reflect a single wavelength. So you get very strong reflection of a single colour. just using this physical scattering of light.
Okay, so when did this structural method of polarisation first evolve?
When did it first evolve? That's a tricky one. When you look at the distribution of modern organisms that have structural colour, you get structural colours in, you get it in insects, you find it in mammals, you find it in birds, you find it in various invertebrates, marine invertebrates like amphipods and copepods and ostracods. It's very, very widespread. And so what's actually thought is that it has evolved independently many, many times in many different animal groups. And even if you look at a single group that's been well studied, like beetles, there's still evidence for multiple independent origins. So structural coloration seems to be a way of making color that has been thought of by many different types of animals.
What's the do you know the earliest record of structural color in the fossil record?
There are fossil insects from the Eocene, from the Messel deposit in Germany, the Messel oil shales, and these have structural colours. These are the oldest fossils that I've worked on that have structural colour. There are hints that, structural colours may be preserved in some Burgess shale animals, but these studies need to be, we need to look at this in a bit more detail. Also, that's arthropods. If you're looking at feathers, structural colour has been inferred for some feathered dinosaurs from the Jehol deposits from the Cretaceous of China.
And what kind of colours were those?
The colours that have been inferred from Microraptor are... they're not very strong colours. They're thought to have been just glossy blacks, basically like the colours in magpie feathers. They're black, but if you get them in the right light, you see greenish highlights.
Are there any limits to which parts of the spectrum can be produced
using structural colours?
Using structural colours.
Structural colours can produce a much broader range of colours than pigments. You can get brighter colours, more intense colours, and purer colours. And in terms of the parts of the spectrum, structural colours can produce everything from your reds right through to your ultraviolets. So there's no part of the spectrum that structural colours, can't generate a visible hue. Structural colours are particularly good, they're particularly common for generating blue colours in a lot of feathers, because blue is very, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to generate using pigments. So a lot of birds will use structural mechanisms to generate blue. And in fact, many green colours in birds it's not produced by a green pigment, it's a combination of a yellow pigment and a blue structural colour. So lots of birds actually do colour mixing in their feathers.
So are these structural colours typically displayed over the entire body or just in specific areas?
They can be displayed over the entire body. When you look at birds, a lot of our questions are about birds. When you look at birds, you can get structural colours everywhere. Crest, wing coverlets, shoulder epaulets, breast, back. You can produce them everywhere. The thing is, a lot of birds don't. They they're localised to specific parts of the body used in display. So, you find them most commonly in crests and shoulders and, front of the wings, for instance.
And in insects?
In insects, typically, it depends on what insect family you're looking at. They can occur over the entire cuticle, and including legs and antennae, or else they can be restricted just to small spots on the elytra. It depends very much on the family.
So in the fossil record, which kind of animals can we see possessing structural coloration?
Most of what we know about structural colors in the fossil record actually comes from insects. There've been a couple of papers on structural colours in feathers, but we know that structurally coloured insects are actually very common in the fossil record. We've found structurally coloured insects. Well, we've worked on structurally coloured insects from 5 or 6 Cenozoic localities. But actually, looking through the literature, there have been reports of metallic insects from 25 or 26 different fossil localities, but they just haven't been studied yet. So, you know, this kind of structural colour is actually really common in fossil insects.
Does the structural preservation preserve better than the melanosomes?
Well, seeing as we don't really know yet how fossilisation affects melanosomes, it's a little bit hard to compare it to preservation of melanosomes. But what we do know a lot about how the fossilisation process affects structural colours. Our work on fossil insects from, you know, Cenozoic localities shows that the colour, the original colours, never survive. It doesn't matter what taxon you're looking at or what locality, the original colours are always altered during the fossilisation process. So, you know, we were really interested in what was causing this colour change. And when you're talking about structural colour, there are only two things that can change the colour. You either change the periodicity, so the size of the little nanostructures that are producing the colour, or else you change their chemistry. But when we were looking on fossils, we couldn't really work out which was responsible. So what we've actually been doing over the last year or so is we've been doing burial experiments on modern insects to actually, you know, simulate this colour change in the lab. So we were putting modern insects into an autoclave and, you know, exposing them to very high temperatures and pressures. We were squashing them, basically. And the colours changed. And what was really neat was they changed the exact same way and extent as we see in the fossils. In the fossils, we were always getting this funny red shift between the actual colours and the colours we were predicting based on the structures, the preserved structures. And when we did our fossilisation experiments in the lab, we saw this same colour shift, this offset. And we were able to explain the change in colour of the beetles. It's actually due to the combined effects of changing the structure and the chemistry. So if you want to reconstruct original colours in fossil insects, you actually need to know a bit about how the chemistry has changed and how the structure has changed. And to do that, you need to have some kind of handle on how much these fossils have been buried. So it's really important when it's always important when you're studying exceptionally preserved fossils to know something about the depositional environment and the diagenetic environment. But when it comes to reconstructing colour, it actually turns out to be critical, because you can't reconstruct original colours unless you know how much your biota has been buried. You have to know the temperature, pressure conditions. And once you know that, well, then you can work backwards and, you know, reconstruct the original colours.
So you said that the red shifted. So would that mean if you squashed a blue insect, it would turn yellow?
Well, that's what it appeared from the fossils. The fossils evidence, it looked as if there was a red shift. But when we did the experiments, the colour change, the major colour change is a blue shift. So basically, when you change the structure, you get a big blue shift in the colour. But still, our predicted colour was red shifted. That's the red shift you're talking about. And that small red shift between the actual colour after the experiment and the predicted colour, that was due to a change in the chemistry. So what happens is, during fossilisation, with the effects of pressure and being squashed, compacted, the layers in the cuticle that are generating the colour, they become thinner, and that's what causes a blue shift. But the chemistry changes as well, and that actually offsets the blue shift a little bit. So it's a combination of the two factors.
So it sounds pretty complex. Are you able to reconstruct the colours then? Reliably?
Not yet. So what we actually need to do is, the plan is to do another batch of experiments. So to actually constrain how colour changes under different pressure temperature conditions, so that we have a reference set of information to go to. So then when we have our fossils, if we know, you know, pretty much what the pressure temperature conditions were, we can just go to our diagram and say, ah, it's stage two or whatever. That's the plan.
But you said that there was multiple times that this structural colour evolved.
Mm.
Would all the individually developed structural colours deform in the same way if they all got the same kind of structure?
Yeah, well, would they have they're very different structures actually. So we did our experiments using two different types of these colour producing structures. We used multilayer reflectors and 3D photonic crystals, and they deform the same way. So it didn't matter that they were organized differently. We still see the same type of color change. So they have similar, these structures have similar preservation potential.
You mentioned in birds that the color can be produced through interaction of structural colors and melanosomes. So in reconstructing color within birds, is it very difficult? Do you need an exceptionally preserved fossil in order to be able to tell the structures and the melanosomes?
Yeah, you know, this is potentially a problem. You know, where you get melanosomes preserved in the fossil feather, it doesn't mean that you didn't have other pigments or other colour-producing structures there as well. So this is something that we're working on at the moment. And so I suppose come back in 6 months or a year, we'll be able to tell you more about that.
You said that there was chemical control on the colour. Has there been much work into that?
In terms of melanin, there's been a bit of, you know, some studies have looked at the chemistry of fossil melanin. And, you know, we've got a fairly good understanding of which techniques are going to work. But we still don't know how the chemistry of melanin changes during fossilization. So this is something that would be really exciting to look at in the future. Because using our squashing technique, for want of a better term, by using our autoclave technique, we can actually simulate what happens to the chemical during fossilization. And we can analyse it using lots of these new techniques that are available, like synchrotron techniques and so on. And so far, studies of melanin, they haven't looked at insects in terms of fossil melanin. So it would be really interesting to actually compare how the chemistry of the molecule changes during fossilization in different groups. You know, does it change the same way? Is it better preserved in some organisms than others? And also, you know, what about the chemistry of other pigments? Because there's got to be more than melanin out there. So these are things that I'd be very excited to work on in the future.
So how does the change in chemistry to melanin affect the interpretation of that structure in a fossil?
We don't know. You know, using certain techniques, like a technique called TOF-SIMS, time of flight secondary ion mass spectrometry, we can identify traces of melanin, little components of the melanin molecule in fossils. But for instance, you know, yeah, we don't know what's happening to the molecule at large. We don't know if the melanin stays in. Is the melanin original to that tissue? So, you know, within a single animal, you can have melanin in your feathers, you can have melanin in your skin, you can have melanin in some of your internal organs. So we don't know if it migrates around or if it stays in place during fossilization. So you know, these are all questions to work on.
Okay, so what is the future of colour research in fossils?
I think it would be very important to do a comprehensive series of experiments to see how the fossilisation process alters colour. So, for instance, we need to investigate how decay changes colour in different organisms, in feathers and insects, and how the burial process changes colours. This will be really important for various fossil groups. You know, and there are other techniques that we can use as well in the future. There has been some application of synchrotron elemental mapping, X-ray fluorescence, to studies of colours and fossil feathers. And this is something that we can potentially apply to fossil insects as well. And actually, you know, because this technique is still in its infancy in how it's applied to studies of fossil colour, you know, we actually could do a whole lot of, you know, calibration of the technique to actually work out quantitatively how much of certain metal ions are being preserved and so on.
Well, Dave, that was really interesting.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I've wanted to do this episode ever since I heard Maria give a talk on this subject here at Bristol University. So I'm glad that we got a chance to talk to her.
Yeah, I think it's amazing the kind of experimental techniques you can use to have a look at the preservation of fossil melanosomes and structural colorization, and work backwards to try and determine the actual colour of the fossils.
Definitely. So you can't take everything that you see in the fossil record literally as it is. The complexities that go into preserving colour in terms of the amount of compaction and any chemical alteration, you just can't look at a fossil and say it's yellow, therefore in the past it must also have been yellow. There's so much to consider.
Another example of the ambiguities of using shape as a diagnosis of structure. So paleontologists are obsessed with shape and describe all kinds of different shapes in all different bones or preserved remains. And as Maria said, in this example, the melanosomes were almost identical to bacteria, completely different entities that are, from a morphological perspective, impossible to distinguish between.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed my time here at Bristol again. I'll have to come back.
Yes, and next time I can hopefully show you some beautiful SEM scans of all kinds of interesting fish.
And next time I still won't have brought you Archaeogonathus.
It's all right, I don't need to. I'm writing an application at the moment. Actually, I shouldn't tell you about that.
Shh. All right. I'm happy with that as the
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.